I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There is growing concern about violent attacks against the civilian population in Syria. A recent massacre in Hula left more than 100 people dead, and about half of them were children. Locals blamed a pro-regime militia, while Syrian President Bashar al-Assad accused foreign-backed extremists of carrying out the mass killing. Last week, the UN Human Rights Council condemned the Syrian government, which has become more isolated, although it still has a powerful ally, Russia. Today on Radio Times, what are the options in dealing with the crisis in Syria? And we asked Andrew Tabler to join us. He's a senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His work focuses on Syria and U.S. relations. He actually lived in Syria from 2001 to 2008, working as a journalist and a media consultant, wrote about his experiences in a book called In the Lion's Den, Inside America's Cold War with Assad Syria. And Andrew Tabler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Are we witnessing, if not a civil war, the beginnings of a civil war in Syria?
It's certainly heading that way. I think that by a lot of definitions, we're already there in the sense that we have a lot of domestic fighting. I think what we have at the moment is an insurgency by a civil and an armed insurgency against the Assad regime by the opposition. Where this gets into a civil war in distinct groups and something more sectarian is that the Assad regime is dominated by Alawites, a heterodox offshoot of Shia Islam, and gathered around them are minorities and other Christians as well in the country. And they rule over the majority Sunni population. So when you have a regime that's structured like that, and it's like Saddam Hussein's regime, it's a minority regime, ruling over a majority in the country, and the opposition is battling it. It quickly can get into the kind of sectarian fighting that we saw in Iraq and that we've seen elsewhere in the region.
How do you understand what the opposition is? Is it largely Sunni? Does it work in coordination? What would be a good description of the opposition today?
I'd say it's largely Sunni, but it's not all. We have Alawites and even Christians involved, but a lot of the minorities are huddling together. The minorities constitute about 25% of the population. In the past, the minorities working together, maintained order in Syria. But the problem is that the minority regime was so corrupt and unable to change over time. And under Bashar al-Assad's rule for the last 12 years, he inherited power from his father, Hafez al-Assad, in 2000. It was unable to change. And meanwhile, the population has changed radically. It's very young, it's among one of the fastest growing in the region. So what we're seeing now in Syria is just systemic failure by this minority-dominated regime over the majority population. And, of course, there is the human toll, and that's what everyone's so concerned about. And that is we've had over 10,000 people killed, 40,000 people are in custody or missing, and unfortunately there's no end in sight to the carnage.
And we'll be talking more about that when we talk with a representative from Human Rights Watch. But you have used the phrase, as have others, and perhaps this is describing Assad as what, dead man walking? What does that mean?
Well, it's actually a term that was used by an Obama administration official last December to describe that President Assad's regime is on its way down. And I think that it is on its way down. It's losing support. It's losing control over parts of the country. Its bottom line is seriously affected by a really good raft of sanctions, which have been leveled against the Assad regime, including oil sanctions on that country. But the problem is that Assad, using raw force and particularly being resupplied by Russia and Iran with arms, can try and shoot his way out of this for some time. And this is what. This sort of model is what the Saudis and a number of others in the region refer to as Assad's killing machine, and we have to make sure that we stop this before it sets off a sectarian war that could draw in all the regional powers, smack in the middle of the Middle East.
Now, yesterday, or maybe it was even today, Assad named a new prime minister. Is there something significant about that? And recently, Syrian diplomats have been expelled from 11 countries, including the United States. Do you think this new prime minister is in response to what members of the international community have been doing?
No, I mean, I think that Assad has tried to put in place a number of sort of cosmetic reforms over the last year that the opposition has not grabbed a hold of, and they have not gone forward with and supported. So I think it's just some more cosmetic changes. I mean, it is a security state. So I think those of you that remember Iraq under Saddam Hussein, it's very similar to that, and they also have Ba'athist ideology as well. The civilian government is just a facade for the security state, so they can make all the changes they want to that, but it's not going to be anything that would clear the streets, and certainly not anything that would give Syrians any kind of relief from the current crackdown.
Now, apparently, some relief organizations are going to have more ability to get to some of the people that have been targeted or certainly in some degree of crisis. Let me just quote from John Ging, Director of Operations for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He said, freedom of movement, unimpeded access for humanitarian action within Syria is what it's all about now. The good faith of the Syrian government will be tested today, tomorrow, and every day. Will they meet that test?
I think that it's good that we have this agreement. The Annan plan itself treats the symptoms of the problem in Syria, and that it can get some relief to people in the country. The bigger problem, though, is that it doesn't really treat the disease itself, and that is this minority-dominated regime that rules over one of the youngest populations in the Middle East. And this would be fine, but these minority-dominated regimes are inelastic, and they're also particularly brutal. If this process was going on earlier, and when this all started in March 2011, I think I would give it more credibility. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I don't see anything pulling us out of that. There's been floated in policy circles that Annan might have a new plan now to set up a contact group on Syria that would involve Russia, which would be a variant of his original plan.
And this is Kofi Annan, who has been trying to negotiate some kind of, I guess, deal with the Assad government.
Correct, exactly, yeah. And so so I think that we'll have to wait and see, but I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
From your perspective, and if the goal is to get more political freedom, more access, more power sharing, more democracy in Syria, can that be done with this particular president?
No. Earlier when I stayed in Syria, I thought so, but he missed his opportunity to carry those reforms out. I have no confidence that can happen. I wish I did.
And would the idea of some kind of an exit for him and his family or his regime, is that an option?
Well, that's what the new Annan proposal is supposedly about. The problem is that apparently, and this is unofficial now, the plan has him staying on until 2014, the end of his second term as president. I can't imagine that the opposition would go for that, and also I think it would just give him an opportunity to kill more people. I also just do not trust that that a minority regime like that can reform itself. But that's just my take based on living there for about 7 years. I know a lot of other Syrians who share my feelings as well.
So is the idea to figure out how to remove him from power, either from within the country or by outside intervention?
That's right. I mean, the policy of the United States is regime change in Syria. We don't talk about it as much as we would like, but certainly that's it. And we're just going to have to see about how to accelerate his departure. And that's what the U.S. government currently does and currently focuses its attention on.
Is there a model you think that works for you? I'm thinking about the Arab Spring. I'm also thinking about Bosnia. Are there lessons from some of these experiences and interventions?
There's the Yemen plan, which was a negotiated exit. The problem, though, is that we don't, you know, Yemen's regime was not a minority-dominated regime, so it's harder. The idea is that the way to get the ruling family to leave is for the military in the country to essentially say, okay, it's time to go. And that's what happened in Egypt and in Tunisia as well with those regimes. In the case of Syria, because they're all the same from the same minority, they huddle together when they're under siege. And I'm afraid that's the situation that we're looking at the moment.
I mean, if Assad were to go, where would he go?
Probably Russia at this point, or Tehran. But it's really unclear. I mean, who would really want to have him, because he would be a massive target for assassinations, not just as a result of the crackdown on the Arab on the current uprising, but the one that was carried out by his father in February of 1982. His father carried out one of the worst massacres in the history of the Middle East in a city called Hama. Between 10,000 and 30,000 people were killed when the regime surrounded the fourth largest city in the country, which is what Hama is, and shelled it. Now the way that's related to what's going on now is that after that crackdown, it was so severe, everyone stayed home for about 10 years, more or less. The economy contracted. People did not organize. They didn't go out, and they stayed home together. And of course, what happens when men and women stay home for long periods of time together without without good TV?
Population growth.
They were among Syria in the 10 years following that massacre was among the 20 fastest growing populations on the planet. All the people born of that time are now swarming the regime. And this is the reason why it's become destabilized, and the reason why that the sooner Assad goes, the better it is for everyone.
About a minute before our first break here, then we're going to talk with you and someone from Human Rights Watch. But why is Russia Syria's best friend in the world?
Because Russia has backed, under the Soviet Union, backed Syria in the Cold War struggle in the Middle East against Israel. They armed the Syrian military, and a lot of weapons transit from Syria to the rest of the region, including into Lebanon and to Hezbollah. They make a lot of money off of their relations with Syria. They have Russia has a naval base in the Syrian city of Tartus. And also, I think, you know, for Russia, Syria allows them to confound U.S. foreign policy and limit its U.S. influence. And so... It's been an ally for decades. It continues to be an ally, and that's why you see Vladimir Putin backing President Assad to the hilt during the current crackdown on the Syrian population.
Well, we are talking about the crisis in Syria with Andrew Tabler, and he's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, spent about 7 or 8 years living in Syria. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we also have a representative of Human Rights Watch to join us as well. Lines open. Any questions or comments about this crisis in Syria and certainly the options both inside and outside the country, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Focus Features, presenting the new film Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson and starring Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, and Tilda Swinton. Moonrise Kingdom, in select theaters now.
The Cooper Heart Valve Center supports WHYY. Aortic valve stenosis affects nearly 300,000 people annually. Cooper is the first hospital in South Jersey offering a new non-surgical valve repair, the Sapien Heart Valve. This FDA-approved technology offers a treatment option for patients unable to undergo valve surgery and is expected to transform the treatment of aortic valve disease. More at 800-8-COOPER or cooperhealth.org/sapien.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe, Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there. June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
PNC Bank and the Barnes Foundation support WHYY and welcome visitors to the Barnes in Philadelphia to experience the vast collection of Picassos, Matisses, Renoirs, and Cezannes in their new home. For details on tickets and programs, barnesfoundation.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about the crisis in Syria, the showdown over Syria. Andrew Tabler is a journalist, a researcher. He lived in Syria, wrote a book about his experiences titled In the Lion's Den. And we are trying to make contact with Ule Solvan from Human Rights Watch. We're calling Beirut or someplace in the region to talk about some of the concerns about human rights crisis in that part of the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Andrew Tabler, from your experience and from even from your contacts in Syria, are war crimes being committed in that country?
Most certainly they are. And I think that the human rights organizations have found that as well. I mean, the Syrian regime is back to using shelling on its third largest city, and it's been doing that for months while the Annan plan's been going on. Now, how does that, in shelling homes, what does that really mean? Well, in a comparative sense, that would be as if the federal government were shelling Chicago. Mm. Now, what's particularly egregious about the position and response of the international community, including the Obama administration, to this, and I'm speaking here not as an opponent to the Obama administration, someone who talks with them actively on this issue, is that the biggest problem is that we have continued to call this a ceasefire when it is not. President Assad, under the Annan plan, committed to withdraw his forces from populated areas on April 10th. And to cease fire on April 12th. He did neither of these things. We continued to call it a ceasefire. We continued to call the Annan plan fragile when it was anything but. It didn't exist. And this is the conundrum that we're in. Because it didn't work, it didn't solve the problem, and we had the massacre in Hola a little over a week and a half ago in which over 100 people, including women and children, were killed both by shelling and by execution by pro-government militias at point-blank range.
Well, let me get Ule Solvan to join us. In fact, joining us from Jordan, he's an emergencies researcher at Human Rights Watch. And most recently, he was in northwest Syria in late April, author of a new report documenting evidence of executions and torture by the Syrian government forces. And Ule Solvan, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And you were on with Andrew Tabler from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and we were talking very just recently about this massacre that took place in Hula, something like 107 or 8 people that were killed, and many of them women and children. What can you tell us about what happened in Hula?
Well, I mean, what we do know is that the army staged an attack, and that as often is the case, the Shabia accompanied the army when the army entered the cities, and the Shabia then killed quite a number of people. You know, what is striking to me is that the Hula massacre is not the only one of its kind. And in fact, when we were in Syria a little while ago, we documented several similar incidents that had happened in northern Idlib when the army attacked and entered the towns. Granted, the numbers were less, but we documented several mass executions of civilians by Shabia and by the army. And, you know, we're seeing the same thing. Right now, I just interviewed one person who helped bury more than 100 people who were apparently executed after an attack on a town called Karmel Zeytun back in March. So even though Hula has gotten a lot of attention, and rightly so, it is by far not the only such massacre that we've seen. And in fact, we're documenting quite a number of these massacres.
And I will get back to you. Let me turn to you, Andrew Tabler. Help us understand who, what Shabia is.
Shabia mean ghosts. They originally, the term refers to the cars, black Mercedes cars, which are primarily driven by Alawites close to the Assad regime. And the Shabiha are primarily minority Alawite and sometimes Christian groups of thugs who dress in macabre clothing oftentimes and are sent in to predominantly Sunni areas to terrorize the population. They've been doing this, and they report directly to the Assad family and those around it. So the Assad regime is not only using its military and its security services, but also the Shabiha. According to the initial findings of the UN, at least some of the deaths in Houla were are the result of the involvement of the Shabiha. They're a terrorizing group. I've seen them across the Lebanese frontier myself. And these people are used as sort of shock forces to sort of get the majority Sunni population to submit to minority rule. The only problem the Assad regime has, of course, is that it's very much not working.
Well, I mean, would you describe it as, if not a terrorist organization, certainly a militia whose goal is to terrorize the population?
Oh, for sure. And the term the Shabiha across the country, though, take on different forms. They, in a lot of areas, they're just known as people who support the Assad regime, and some of them in other areas have mostly just been involved in harassing those who oppose President Assad. They even attacked those in Damascus attacked Ambassador Robert Ford.
Oh, right.
Before he left the country as well, as well as other U.S. diplomats. Let me tell you, apparently facing these thugs is a harrowing experience from those who have done so.
Well, Ole, let me go back to you and go back to this report. As you said, these were attacks on towns and villages around Idlib, the city of Idlib. What did you find from the interviews that you did about who was targeted, how these attacks were carried out, and who was responsible?
Well, it was quite clear to us that that many of these attacks were targeted. The basic pattern we saw, having done more than 60 interviews in 5 towns in northern Idlib, was that the army would surround a town, it would shell it starting in the morning. Very quickly, the Free Syrian Army, the opposition fighters, would realize that they were outnumbered, and they would withdraw from the city, and the army would then enter the towns accompanied by the Shabiha. Quite often in these towns, the security forces then went house to house, searching for specific people according to lists that they had brought with them. Some of the people on these lists were arrested, while others were apparently executed. In one town, we saw that the security forces and the Shabiha were targeting one family in particular in Taftanas. 19 members, at least 19 members of the Ghazal family were killed. In other places, we saw that they went after people like the chant leader, the person who was leading the chant during the demonstrations. In one place, the chant leader was a 25-year-old student who was taken out and executed. We also saw the same thing in terms of destruction. That's another really striking aspect of what we discovered. Literally hundreds of houses in each of these towns, and these are not big towns, hundreds of houses were burned down and destroyed. And again, there was a pattern of targeting families of those who were active in the opposition, those whose family members were part of the opposition forces, etc. In terms of who are responsible for these attacks, it's quite clear that it was a combination of army forces, security and intelligence services, and the Shabiha. And we know, based on graffiti that was left behind by the soldiers, that the 76th Tank Brigade, for example, was involved. So we have a good idea about some of these perpetrators. But we see this pattern all over Syria, and we have documented in the past based on interviews with defectors, both from the army and from the security and intelligence services, that responsibility for these crimes go very high up. We've documented orders to shoot on peaceful protesters, orders to subject people, detainees, to torture that go quite high up in the chain of command. And what is quite clear is that the lack of responsibility, the lack of basically that there is an official policy of tolerating this that goes all the way up to the president.
And I do need to reintroduce you both. We are talking about the crisis in Syria, and the voice you just heard is Ule Sovan. He's an emergencies researcher at Human Rights Watch, was recently in the country documenting some of these human rights violations. Also with us is Andrew Tabler. He's a senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Spent a number of years living and working in Syria. In fact, I wrote about his experiences in a book called In the Lion's Den, Inside America's Cold War with Assad's Syria. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And let me go back to you, and based on what Ole was just describing to us, which sounds like a kind of a scorched earth policy that's been used in parts of Syria, is this a continuation of what has been done in the previous regime?
Most definitely. I think it's a continuation. It's the way they rule. It's the only way that they can rule about, you know, and for a minority regime to maintain its control is to use the fear factor. The problem is that the Assad regime is that people are just not having any of it. They continue to stay out in the streets and fight the regime for over a year and a half. I don't see any end in sight to this, sadly.
And we also hear, Ole, about detentions, torture, disappearances, that's also, you know, part of this crisis in Syria.
Absolutely. You know, I've worked in many situations where torture has been a real problem. But I have to say, you know, on a personal level, I haven't seen any place that is as bad as in Syria when it comes to torture. The systematic nature of it, the numbers that are being detained and tortured, but also the horrific nature of the torture that is being committed is quite astounding. And basically what you have is the intelligence and security services that are running a network of secret underground detention facilities where people are being detained, ill-treated and tortured completely out of any international or domestic laws, and this is something that continues. We've documented, we've interviewed by now several hundred torture victims, and right now here in Jordan, I'm waiting for one person who is about to cross the border, and he was just released from 10 days of horrific torture. Who we will hopefully interview in the next coming days. But also in terms of, you know, what is striking to me is also, you know, I heard you talk a little bit about, you know, the so-called ceasefire and the peace plan. One thing that I don't think that the international community has really tried yet, and this is, of course, because of Russia's opposition to it, is to pose a credible threat of accountability for these crimes. And this is something that we saw very, very clearly in our research in northern Idlib, in northern Syria. The people who were committing these horrific abuses, executing people, they were doing so in plain view, without even trying to mask their identity. Several of the witnesses that we spoke to were able to recognize local agents of the security and intelligence services. And this really tells me that the perpetrators of these crimes, these violations, they do not consider at all that they might have to answer for them. And this is one of the things that I think we need to try to change. You know, I don't think anybody operates under the illusion that in and of itself will end all violations overnight, but really it's something that hasn't been seriously tried. tried yet. And as I said, much because of Russia's continued opposition to these steps.
Well, let me see what Andrew Tabler says in response to that. Can do you think, knowing what you know about life inside of Syria, can these people be held accountable?
Yes, if the regime goes. And I think that's the reason why this is President Assad stepping aside is a solution. I don't see how there's an accommodation, I mean, between this regime at this point and the opposition at large. I think the government should be held accountable. I don't know why we haven't done it until now. I think it was because we wanted this soft landing, this other exit. The problem is it's not happening. Kofi Annan is throwing another plan out there today, indirectly. I don't think it's going to end the killing. I don't think the opposition is going to accept it, and I think it's just another attempt to pretend that we're dealing with the problem when we're really not.
But what does it mean to hold the Assad regime accountable? I mean, are there certain words that you're looking for, Andrew?
Well, I think it's better to, I mean, but I think that what we're looking at here is, you know, something that would be within the realm of not only the Human Rights Commission at the UN, but also the International Criminal Court. That's the reason why people haven't gone with that until now is they thought that would make it easier for Assad to go, more enticing. But as we know, President Assad never does anything unless he absolutely has to. Perhaps putting him into that dilemma would be an important one for the United States if it wants to achieve its objective for him to step aside.
Ule, we have to say goodbye to you in about a minute or so, a minute and a half or so. Have there been human rights violations by opposition fighters?
There have been, and we have published reports about that, and we've sent a letter to opposition leaders a couple of months ago. And of course, you know, it's something that is worrying, and it is very important that opposition leaders take that, you know, very seriously, send clear messages, give the right instructions and orders that these kinds of abuses are completely unacceptable. At the same time, I think it is very important to keep in mind that these violations by opposition groups are not comparable to what we've seen from government forces, which has been involved and committing crimes against humanity in Syria for the last year or so.
And final question to you, what are you hoping for in the next, let's say, week or several weeks looking ahead?
What we are working to make happen is some of what Andrew was alluding to. We want to see the Security Council coming together very quickly decide to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court. We also want the Security Council to impose sanctions on individuals implicated in committing these abuses, and we want the Security Council to decide to adopt an arms embargo on Syria, and thereby, by doing these three things, really sending a strong message to Syria's leaders that this can't go on, and that somebody will be held accountable for these crimes at some point.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for your work as well. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Ule Solvan, and he's emergencies researcher at Human Rights Watch. Andrew Tabler staying with us for the rest of the hour, a senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His work focuses on Syria and U.S. relations. We are talking about the crisis and, frankly, the crimes being committed within Syria. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Ego Poe Classic Theater supports WHYY and is proud to present A Dybbuk at the Prince Music Theater now through June 17th. Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning playwright Tony Kushner brings his poetic flair to this legendary tale of love, ghosts, and faith. The Philadelphia premiere of this haunting Jewish drama of a young bride-to-be possessed by the spirit of her dead beloved. A Dybbuk at the Prince Music Theater. Tickets online at egopoe.org or 800-595-4TIX.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music. Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964. They are currently performing research to develop improved treatments for people who experience periods of depression followed by uncontrollable shifts between highly energized and depressive moods. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. The protests against the regime of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad began more than a year ago. It's estimated that 10, maybe 12, maybe even more civilians have been killed since then. Syria has become more isolated by the international community, but it still has a very influential ally, and that would be Russia. We're talking about all of this with Andrew Tabler, a journalist and researcher who lived in Syria, wrote a book about his experiences in the Lion's Den. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What should be done about Syria? Let me get to Rona from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Rona, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks there. For the show, and
you're
thanks
welcome.
For taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the history of this dispute. I remember when Bashar Assad came into power after his father died. The word, you know, the publicity was that he was a reformer, that he was going to democratize Syria, bring it into the modern world. Was that just a sort of a PR stunt, or has something changed? I'm really curious about that.
Ron, it's a good question. Andrew Tabler, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's what my book is about, at least the first part of it. And I went to Syria during that time. I knew President Assad and his wife very well. I started one of the first English language magazines in the country, and what I found during that time was a regime that was not reforming, even close to it. In fact, was so corrupt it was dysfunctional. And in chapter 3 of the book, you can find out how to turn down a bag of money that the regime
right.
is offering you and still
exactly.
stay there. It's not a regime that's worth betting on. And was it a PR stunt? Yes, I think though that the bigger problem is that when you get to a point where it's clear that it's not reforming, the bigger problem was that we had a lot of people in the United States who were continuing to say that President Assad was reforming and was changing when it was very clear that he wasn't. And that was, I think, all the reforms, including most of the economic reforms, essentially ground to a halt in 2004. And after that, it was an example of a regime that was in stasis. Unfortunately, a lot of people, journalists in particular, you know, have a hard time getting into Syria, and they'll do almost anything to get a visa. Unfortunately, they have to say a lot of things, positive things about the regime and those that work for it in order to get that story.
And from your perspective, and I know I've been looking at a piece you wrote for Foreign Policy talking about the various options, choices, but what do you if you could advise President Obama, what should the U.S. do?
The U.S., if it wants Plan A, which is the soft landing where the Russians cut the Assad regime loose and are forced to get the military and some of their assets in the military to get rid of the Assad family, they're going to have to see that the country is plunging towards some kind of greater, you know, chaos. I think that's already on its way.
You think it's too late for Plan A?
Plan A, I don't think is going to work. I think what we need to do is prepare, and we have a Plan B. We're just not doing it. We have to, you know, better support the Syrian opposition, and we're doing that with non-lethal support. Our allies are giving lethal support. The problem is that our allies in the Arab Gulf share our short-term interests of bringing down the Assad regime. They do not share our long-term interests of a Western-oriented and a non-Islamist Syrian government coming to power after Assad leaves. That's a problem. And by allowing them to do that, to fund the armed opposition, we're handing over a lot of our levers to them. And if we can see which way it's going, I think it's very important that we take the responsible choices now and until it's too late.
But I'm thinking about the Arab Spring and its impact on other countries in the region. Is that a kind of a cautionary tale about what should or shouldn't be done about Syria?
Well, this is just it. I think there are a lot of people who think that if we don't get involved, somehow civil war or these, you know, this conflict is going to go away and we're not going to see the rise of more extremism. No, that we've stayed out of it until now. We've given some assistance to the opposition, very, very little. And what we see now is the situation getting worse. There's more bloodletting. There's a massacre. Al-Qaeda affiliates are now setting off bombs in the country. I think it's hard to argue now that doing very little is the best solution. Now, does that mean that we're talking about invading the country like we did Iraq in 2003? No. Does that mean that we're talking about airstrikes like we were in Libya, missile strikes? No. We're talking about working with the Syrian opposition to help them take power. And I think that's something that Americans understand back in their own revolutionary experience. A lot of the opposition and those that have picked up arms are not terrorists, shooting indiscriminately at people. In fact, these groups, these extremist groups, are people who are taking advantage of the process. Mm-hmm. Most of the Free Syrian Army elements are like the Minutemen of the American Revolution. They go out, they protect protesters, they protect civilians, and a lot more Syrians are alive because they went out there and put their own necks on the line.
You're talking about the U.S. sharing more intelligence with these opposition groups?
Absolutely. And now, does that mean we give away everything? Does that mean that we tell them where we got it from? No. Do we have an obligation to tip off civilians if we can see an army column or a division on the way to a populated area where they're about to shell it or about to lay siege to it or to invade it? We certainly do. Why not? It doesn't cost us anything. Right. The Syrians can't shoot down our satellites, and we owe it to those people who have been out in the streets for a year and a half struggling against their government. And by the way, a regime which is not an ally of the United States, which is Iran's closest ally in the region, and one that if this regime goes down, it would be a serious blow for the Iranians and a serious plus for the United States.
But you don't think the U.S. is doing that now, sharing intelligence?
I think it is covertly. I don't think that it's doing anything overtly, and it's not doing it on a massive scale. A lot more could be done.
Let me get Wolfgang from Princeton to join our conversation. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Really fascinating interview. And I wholeheartedly agree with 99% of the interviewee. My question concerns the regional dimension. Mm-hmm. Because of the various groups, minorities and also religious groups, we have now basically all neighboring states from Jordan to Lebanon to Iraq to Turkey involved, indirectly at least, and Lebanon obviously because of Hezbollah quite more involved. Now the real big issue is the relationship Syria-Israel. The two countries are still at a state of war, legally, but de facto, since decades, in a state of peace along the border. And I know for a fact that Israel has a great vested interest in having this and continue. And as we are all aware, Syria not only has major support from Russia, but also from Iran. So my question to your guest is, how do you see that, and especially, how do we deal with this when time is running out?
It's an excellent question, Wolfgang. Thank you for you were a guest in the past, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Andrew Tabler, talk about a complicated neighborhood.
Yeah, I think that the Israelis have an interest in having a peaceful border with Syria if the regime there is able to maintain order and it's stable. The problem is that it's not. The regime's been destabilized. And on top of that, Assad has allowed Palestinians to go across that border a couple of times as a way to deflect attention away from what's going on internally inside the country. So I think the Israelis understand that what's going on in Syria has nothing to do with them. It has to do with the governance and simply the demographic situation skewed against the Assad regime. Now, does that mean, so then the greater question is, I think though, that they've been concerned for well over a decade. Bashar al-Assad has gotten closer and closer and closer to the Iranians and to Hezbollah under his reign over the last 12 years. And this is something which has disturbed them. Are they worried about what comes next? Sure. Do they think they can affect the outcome? I think they believe they can do very little other than just kind of sit it out and maybe make some statements here, there, and everywhere. But until now, I think they realize the situation is outside of their hands.
Let me get Christine from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. Christine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much. Great
You're
show.
Good
morning, sir. I have a question. I'm an immigration attorney, and I handle a number of asylum cases, many involving Christians from the Middle East. And my question for you is, I know that Christians are in a rather untenable situation there because they are sort of tied to the Alawite regime, to Assad. What do you think, how do you think the United States, what should our posture be with respect to protecting that minority, which right now seems to be aligned with the regime, while at the same time recognizing that Assad is a brutal despot?
Thanks, Christine. Yeah, go ahead, Andrew Taylor.
Yeah, it's something, you know, as a Christian, I can't recommend to any other Christian to stand by a regime like this as it carries out these kind of murders. And here's why. I think there's a moral question to it, and I'm not going to get into that. But I think that there is an issue of just a community's long-term interest. It's a dilemma for the Christian community, and I know them very well in Syria. They think that in the short term that the Assad regime somehow defends their interests. I don't think so, because the problem is that the Christian community, by huddling around the Alawites and those that are running the country, when that system totally fails, they risk retribution and revenge killings by extremists from all walks of life against the Christian population. So what the U.S. has done is that they've urged the Christian population to look at the situation and to make their bets. And unfortunately, until now, most of the Christian population inside of Syria have huddled around the Alawites. So it's very complicated. It's one that I understand the Christian community is in a tight spot. I think it's where your long-term interests meet your short-term interests that you have to make a decision. And they're going to have to do that sooner rather than later, I'm afraid.
Christine, thanks for the call to Radio Time. So if Iran and Russia are sending arms to the Assad regime, and you've written about this, Andrew Taylor, what about an arms embargo? Would that stop the flow of arms, but would it sort of increase tensions and temperatures in that region?
It would. I've talked about that and written about it. I think it's a good idea. You know, what's really ironic is you have the Russians saying that that the regional countries are stirring the pot and arming the opposition, when Russian arms shipments continue to dock in Syrian ports, and as do Iranian shipments as well in the airports. This is hypocrisy of the first kind. Mm-hmm. We have to stop the arms coming into Syria as best we can from all sides. If the Russians are going to demand that those that are arming the Syrian opposition elsewhere in the region stop while they continue, that's a non-starter, and that's not a conversation that anyone's going to have.
Is there a refugee crisis related to this crisis within Syria?
Absolutely. We have, at least officially, upwards of 70,000 people in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. Mm-hmm. Those are the official numbers, but you have many others, tens of thousands, which are displaced. And you have 300,000 people or so who are displaced within the country itself. This is a humanitarian crisis that is growing, and I think you saw in the news here the last couple of days that the Syrian regime has recognized actually the situation is so bad and has allowed some humanitarian shipments into populated areas.
One of your other suggestions, and I'm quoting here, encourage the Kurds and Arab tribes in eastern Syria to fully support the uprising. How would that work?
Well, they'd have to come on and start protesting more, and I guess the armed elements out there, which have been growing in a number of attacks, would have to increase. So I think we would see that happen. And if we do that, that will overstretch the regime's elite divisions. causing them to go east and give them less resources to crack down on the populations in the western part of the country where the uprising has been the strongest.
You know this Assad family, and I'm not asking you to get into the head of President Bashar al-Assad, but how do you think that family and perhaps even the president is understanding what's going on inside his country?
President Assad is a very moody individual who is very unpredictable, and I think those that have engaged him can tell you, as I can, that you're amazed at how a man who seems so affable, and his wife as well, when you leave the room after a conversation with them, which seemed quite reasonable, that they go out and do exactly the opposite. It's a kind of, I wouldn't call it, I don't know if it's schizophrenia or bipolar tendency, I don't exactly know what it is. I think it's just a fact that this is the way President Assad rules. He's a Janus-faced dictator who a lot of us had a lot of hopes for. I'm not saying this as someone who comes from an ideological standpoint at all. I'm saying this as someone who had a close-up experience with this regime. It's not one that President Assad is not worth betting on. He's diametrically opposed in his policies to the United States, and the sooner that he leaves, the better for the Syrian people as well as for the United States as well.
And how do you think this is all going to end? I don't even know if that's a fair question.
Yeah, I don't know. I think very bloodily, sadly, and I don't see an easy way out for this. But the first part of addressing a problem, as we all know, is recognizing there is one. If we continue to call the Annan plan functional, when it's not, and we don't prepare for the worst, I think we're only fooling ourselves.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you were able to give us so much time this morning. Andrew Tabler, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
And he's a journalist, a researcher, lived in Syria, wrote a book about his experiences in the lion's den inside America's Cold War with Assad, Syria. And he's now a senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Also talked with Ule Sovan from Human Rights Watch about the crisis in Syria. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also go to whyy.org/Radio Times and find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.